What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Dahlia Rosenfield, the author of the award-winning book of short stories, The Worlds We Think We Know. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our Shinshiniot Young Representatives of Israel, Rotem Rappaport and Ron Benicote. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. Yesterday was the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing, the first time in history when a human being set foot on a heavenly body. It's quite beyond conception that it's actually half a century since Neil Armstrong took, as he put it, one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. When you realize NASA put men on the moon using less computing power than the average smartphone has today, the fact that America did this five decades ago becomes even more amazing. In May of 1961, when John F. Kennedy announced the goal of landing on the moon within the decade, it was, to be honest, a long shot. That it was accomplished just over 8 years later was one of the great achievements in American history, comparable in commitment, scientific advance, and energy to the Manhattan Project, or perhaps the building of the Panama Canal. And for a while, we were landing on the moon with regularity. The question of why we wanted to do this and what exactly we'd do after we landed on the moon was never exactly answered except by futurists and science fiction authors. In essence, we went to the moon because of the Cold War. We had to prove that we could do it before the Soviet Union did, since they had launched a satellite before we did, Sputnik, and put a man in space orbiting Earth before we did that as well, Yuri Gagarin. Still, what a goal, and what a project. It was a thrilling time. Every Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo launch was a huge event, the news story of the week or month. And the danger was tremendous. Some of those spacecraft blew up and killed the astronauts. But when those flights succeeded, and they usually did, they marked genuinely new moments of accomplishment in human history.
Shine on, Harvey Bloom. Up in the sky, you have been in orbit since January, February, June, and July. Don't come back too soon. We rented out your room. So shine on, Harvey Bloom, up there on the moon. We'll miss you on the holidays. This year they're coming later. We hope you have a very lovely Seder in your crater. Your mama sent the astronauts some chicken soup at school. They're using it instead of rocket fuel.
A question that is often asked about dramatic historic events is this. Do you remember where you were when? So, do you remember where you were when Neil Armstrong first walked on the surface of the moon, July 20th, 1969? I know I do. I was 8 years old. I was watching the moon landing in our across-the-street neighbor's home in Los Angeles because they had the only color TV on the whole block. As I recall, their names were the Gardners, and they were extraordinary not only for their color TV, but also because they were one of the very few non-Jewish families on the block. The event was very exciting at the time. The space program and NASA itself were wildly popular and almost overwhelmingly inspirational. A man was going to land on the moon. The science and technology involved were stunning to us in those days. They still are, really. And the fact that we were actually watching this happen on a warm summer evening in Southern California was surreal. The grainy, oddly tinged video images from the moon were slow to come in, but we kids remained transfixed. If I am not mistaken, Walter Cronkite, the official voice of everything important, was talking about the historic event to come, and then it actually happened, a man walking on the moon. And Neil Armstrong's historic words broadcast live. This is one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. It was amazing, the whole thing. The fact of human beings on the moon and the additional miracle of actually watching it happen in what we did not then call real time. I do remember being impressed by the fact that Neil Armstrong's words did not sound like a spontaneous inspiration, even to an 8-year-old. But otherwise, we watched the event with a full consciousness that something astonishing was happening. Think about it. In less than 10 years, we went from having not much of a space program to landing a man on the moon, watching him walk around there, plant the U.S. flag, and we brought him and the other guy who was up there, Buzz Aldrin, home safely. Amazing indeed. Well, one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. Note the language, man, mankind. We did not make it egalitarian in those days, did we? I suppose today we'd say one small step for humans, one giant leap for humanity. Doesn't scan quite as well, but the message is powerful 5 decades later. What an extraordinary step it truly was, 50 years ago yesterday. And yet, 50 years later, most of the predictions about what would follow this pioneering landing have proven to be illusory. There are no cities on the moon, no colonies on Mars, no regular space travel for all citizens. We haven't even speeded up our regular air travel with supersonic flights, let alone space shots. In fact, with all the airline delays and security problems and canceled flights, I think it probably takes longer to get from here to there now than it did back in 1969. We just never really know the end results of our efforts, of the major transformative experiences we live through. We have had the privilege of having Jewish astronauts as guests here on Too Jewish. They are incredibly inspirational. I must admit, there's something amazing about talking to people who have slipped the surly bonds of Earth, treading the high untrespassed sanctity of space, put out their hands and touched the face of God, as poet John McGee wrote of flying. People who have been in space are changed by that experience of reaching a place our species has dreamed of, well, forever. With the advent of private spaceflight and the ever-increasing speed of information technology, we are now much closer to making space travel something lots of people could access. Maybe. We also thought that would happen many times over the past 50 years, and, well, not so much. But then, maybe that wasn't ever really the point. The idea of having goals that go beyond ourselves, that cause us to reach for the heavens, this is not just a simple thing. It is a profoundly Jewish goal. When things seem impossible to achieve, Judaism teaches that is only a temporary condition. The Jewish nation of Israel, founded after 1,800 years of statelessness, helps prove that even the apparently unachievable may ultimately be accomplished. When Israel launched its Space IL unmanned craft this year, it was a kind of full circle, the impossible nation sending out a lunar landing craft. It did reach the surface of the moon. Unfortunately, it crash-landed on the moon. But that was something amazing in and of itself. Again, it was in the most important way the effort that mattered, the reach that exceeded the grasp that helps us understand how human beings, working together, can achieve something truly great. There's a teaching in Judaism in Pirkei Avot, Makom She'ein Anashim Hishtadel Lehiyot Ish, which means in a place where no one is a mensch, strive to be a mensch. That is, where no one else is acting well, do the right thing anyway. At least that's how it's usually understood. But I think we can extend that here. When no one else believes you can achieve a desirable, impossible goal, work hard to make it happen. That is the promised land. Play us in this morning, the day after the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, here's an Israeli song that was popular way back then in 1969, Al Kapav Yavi, about people waiting and working for the coming of Elijah the prophet. and preparing.
ברחובינו הצר גר נגר אחד מוזר הוא יושב בטריפו ולא עושה דבר איש אינו בא לקנות ואין איש מבקר ושנתיים שהוא כבר אינו מנגר שנים חולם הוא שיזכה לו על סודו שומר ומחכה לו מתי כבר יגיע היום ברחובינו הצר גר סנדלר אחד מוזר יושב בצריפו ולא עושה דבר מדפיו הריקים מחוסים באבק כבר שנתיים מונח המרצה הבשר יושב ומחכה לו כבר שנים חולם הוא שיזכה לו על סודו שומר ומחכה לו מתי כבר יגיע היום בירושלים ישנו איש לגמרי לא צעיר שבנה הרבה בתים בכל פינות העיר הוא מכיר כל סמטה
That was Rivka Zohar singing a classic Israeli song from the time of the moon landing, Al Kapav Yavi. Our guest this morning is a wonderful young writer, Dalia Rosenfeld. She lives mostly in Israel now, author of the award-winning book of short stories, The World We Think We Know. Meet her when we return in a moment on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Dalia Rosenfeld is a writer and instructor of creative writing at Bar Ilan University in Israel. Her book, The Worlds We Think We Know, an extraordinary collection of short stories, was a finalist for the Sammy Rohr Prize in Jewish Literature this year. She's currently working on a novel. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning and thanks for having me on the show.
So, really like your book, first of all.
thank you.
Short stories, I want to talk about that as a medium. A lot of times authors start with short stories and then graduate to novels. I don't necessarily think that's a fair assessment. What do you think about the short story as a form?
So that's exactly what I'm doing now. I have, but I will take issue with your verb choice. And I don't feel like I've graduated to the novel, but I've it's I think I've made sort of a lateral move to the novel. So the first collection took me ages and ages to write, and most of the stories are written in first person, and I've since switched to third person, and I like the sort of expansive feel of the novel, but of course I love the instant gratification of writing the short story, finishing the short story, and then seeing it in print when I was lucky enough to get a piece published. But I think for sure it's a lateral move and not a step up to write a novel. There's so much to explore in a condensed fashion in the short story form.
I certainly accept the emendation. It's a better phrasing. Your stories often deal with alienation, crossing boundaries. It's an interesting feel. Do you feel that's true about them?
I feel that certainly the critics have pointed that out, and I don't think I set out to explore those themes sort of explicitly, but they certainly weave their way through the stories in interesting, sometimes surprising moments. In terms of physical dislocation, I was writing the stories, half of the stories in the book are set in Israel and half in the States in small college towns. And I guess ironically, or maybe not, I wrote the stories set in Israel when I was in the States and vice versa. So there was that feeling, I guess, of alienation dislocation because I was writing them from different settings than where I was actually at the moment.
They're very Jewish, if maybe even too Jewish. I don't know.
Are you going to ask me to define that, or can I ask you to?
We can trade.
Okay.
Jewish, they're immersed in sort of the Jewish experience. Is that, can you explore that a little bit?
Sure. My own experience, I guess, is not a familiar one to most people because I grew up very Jewish in a very not Jewish town in Indiana, Bloomington, Indiana.
Right.
Sort of an oasis in the sense that it's a college, big college, university.
Great college town, correct.
Great college town. Yeah. So I did have a lot of culture around me all the time, but still not a very Jewish town. Although my father, for many years, he founded and ran the Jewish studies program there for many years. So I certainly felt I was in a very Jewish place, and only looking back did I maybe realize, and while I was in school, that I, wasn't, and I was sort of one of the few Jewish students. So that informed, my identity growing up, feeling like a little bit like an outsider, but also like a special outsider with certain privileges because interesting people were always coming through our house. And then, of course, meeting people from New York and the real Jewish centers of America made me feel also like an outsider. Like I didn't have, when I was sent to Jewish summer camps in the summer, I couldn't have felt like doubly an outsider, even though I was among Jews, fellow Jews. So there was lots of experiences to draw upon in the writing.
Because you didn't come from, Highland Park or something.
Exactly.
Right.
Whatever accent I had, it wasn't anyone else's accent.
It is a unique accent. We'll talk about that, too, when we come back with Dahlia Rosenfeld, the author of The Worlds We Think We Know, here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills and northwest Tucson, celebrates its first services, classes, and events this summer. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to all throughout the Tucson metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services Friday and Saturday, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha is located at 7315 North Oracle Road, north of Ina on the west side of Oracle. Services, classes, and events are open to all. Join us Friday night, 7315 North Oracle Road, for Shabbat evening services at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning Torah studies at 9 a.m., followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Join us this Shabbat, 7315 North Oracle, on the west side of Oracle, north of Ina, and for my new Summer Adult Education Academy course, Talk About It, Gossip, Slander, and the Ethics of Speech, Tuesday nights at 7. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services, our great religious school, our Torah Tikes program, our teen programming, and our rich array of Summer Adult Education Academy courses, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org. That's BeitSimcha Tucson.org. Or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me in the newest Jewish community and the fastest growing in southern Arizona at its exciting beginning. We welcome back a randomly occurring two-Jewish segment, Zen Judaism, Kohans, or Koans of Wisdom. Learn of the pine from the pine. Learn of the bamboo from the bamboo. Learn of the kugel from the kugel. And if there is no self, whose arthritis is this? That was Zen Judaism, Moments of Mystical Peace, here on Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or ekvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, twojewishradio.com, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts, top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking the last couple of weeks about a controversy that swirled around the use of concentration camps by Congresswoman Alejandra Ocasio-Cortez, but also by responses from the Holocaust Center in Washington saying that the term Holocaust can really only be used to apply to the Shoah, to the Holocaust of the Jews from 1930s up to 1945. I think this is even more sensitive issue and a more emotional issue for Jews than talking about concentration camps, which was our cheerful subject last time. But it's important. There have been other genocides in human history, none necessarily at the exact scale or with the exact direction of the Nazi Holocaust of the Jews. How do we talk about them? What kind of terms can we use? And what's acceptable for Jews?
Well, clearly none of these subjects is very cheerful. The subject of choice of language and who gets to make it and what choices are legitimate or not can be cheerful. It can even be funny. We're just not focusing on those parts of it right now. But I think, yeah, I mean, there have been lots of genocides throughout human history, and they have not all been conducted in the same way or on the same scale as the Holocaust. And the Holocaust, to my knowledge, is the only genocide that is referred to as the Holocaust, which is originally a Greek word meaning a burnt offering, because mountains of Jews were burned, cremated, after being put to death in gas chambers. It was a huge-scale operation that was interested in speed, efficiency, and low cost. So the Germans tasked scientists and engineers to figure out a way of eliminating people as quickly as possible, as cheaply and as efficiently as possible. And it was essentially a burnt offering of millions of Jews. And it ended up effectively destroying traditional Jewish life in Eastern Europe, and particularly in rural places that our grandparents or great-grandparents would have referred to as shtetls, shtetlach. Those are gone, and they'll never be back. Other genocides have, in that sense, been less successful. And sometimes groups of people appropriate the term genocide when it may not be entirely applicable in order to gain some sympathy or some hope of reparations, or the kind of recognition that Jews got in the post-war period, particularly from Germany, which, as long as it was divided into East and West Germany, the Federal Republic of Germany, the FRG, Bundesrepublik Deutschland, spent a lot of money trying to compensate descendants of Jews who were killed or who had their property stolen, who lost everything
in one sense or another. That they established, the various means they had of trying to make things better.
Right.
You know, I think I would tend to agree, you know, for a while, it doesn't seem right that any terrible event can be called the Holocaust. It's not, it's just not true. And I think there's a uniqueness to that, that needs to remain. God willing, there's no more genocides to refer to as anything, but the history of the world wouldn't lead you in that direction.
Right. Given the sweep of human history, it seems unlikely that that noble wish will be realized or fulfilled at any point in the foreseeable future.
One may still hope. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Bernie is unfortunate enough to be hit by a Mack truck, and he's in the hospital in intensive care. His best friend Morris comes to visit him. Bernie struggles to tell Morris, "My wife Sadie visits me 3 times a day. She's so good to me. Every day she reads to me at the bedside." "That's lovely," Morris says. "And what does she read to you?" And Bernie answers, "My life insurance policy." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. We welcome our Shin Shiniot, Ron Benakot, and Rotem Rappaport, representing the Weintraub Israel Center and Israel as young representatives in your last couple of sessions here. So I have to ask you guys, Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
What were your favorite experiences? What are your favorite things about your year-long experience here as Israeli representatives in America?
So there's a lot of different aspects to what we do. Obviously, I really loved my work and the people that I worked with, the kids, bringing Israel and talking about Israel. But if you ask me in general, I would probably say the people, the community. Everyone are so warm and welcoming, and you know, people brought us into their houses and their families, and that was amazing. I always think, like, I'm so grateful for those people that they don't know us, they don't know me, and they just let me stay in their house, even if it's just, you know, for dinner. I'm really grateful for that, and just for all the times, you know, that I've learned new things from them and just laughed and got to know new people and new, like, personalities. I think I learned a lot just by that.
So I agree with Ron. I think my favorite part in this year was the community, the feeling of community, the welcoming people, like no matter what state I was or what was I was going through, the people here always lifted me up and made me feel like home and made sure that I was okay and what they can do to help. I feel like they really wanted us to feel good here, not just because, to make Tucson look good, but because they really cared about us and they really wanted to make sure we're, like, having, like, a good time. I couldn't be more grateful for any of that. Like, it's totally not taken for granted from mm-hmm. my eyes. I truly appreciate every single person that I met throughout the year, even if it was like for 2 minutes.
Every single person.
Every single
you didn't
person.
Meet one person you didn't appreciate.
No, I appreciate every single one. Because
it's a great
I know
lesson
everyone
for the rest of us who maybe don't always pull that off.
And no matter what I was going through with that person, it doesn't matter because they all did it from a good intention, and that's what like means the most to me.
And next week we'll talk about what might have been most challenging about this, but if you're going to take one thing back with you, what would it be? You can't take the people.
Ooh,
right?
That's a really hard question. I don't know. I felt like I changed so much during this year, really, that there's a lot of like things in me that are new that I'm taking back. If I could take one thing.
You could take one thing from the
Creator. Wow, that's a really hard question.
Yeah, yeah, I specialize in hard questions. I mean, the one thing you didn't say that was your favorite thing is, of course, being on the Two Jewish Radio Show, which
yes,
we all know
definitely.
We took that for granted, of course.
I mean, I didn't even think that I have to say that. You know, it's obvious.
Of course, we all know that. Yeah. But, Rotem, is there one thing you could take back? What would it be, do you think?
I think I would take back, I don't know really to explain it, but the feeling of community, the feeling like yeah. for me to do the stuff that people here did for me.
Yeah.
To
kind of open their homes
yes,
and lives
open
to
their
you
hearts.
And open their hearts
yes.
as representatives of Israel.
Yeah.
And because you guys are great. Thank you. We will talk one more time next week.
Thank you.
And now a word of Torah. This week in our portion of Pinchas, we learn of a Brit Shalom, a covenant of peace given by God to Pinchas, a member of the priestly family. The covenant is a commitment to lead worship, to help others fulfill the requirement of avodah, service to God, in a public forum. Peace is the result of such successful service, and this eternal covenant of peace is its sign. For when we connect with God fully, we can reach personal peace as well as communal peace, both of which are among the greatest of God's blessings. Each worshiper in Pinchas' day came to the experience with his or her own needs and desires. Each individual sought something somewhat different. The charge that Pinchas received was to create a service that literally grew peace, that assisted in making out of the disparate parts a greater whole. It has been nearly 2,000 years since we last offered ritual sacrifices as a means of collective worship of God. We know that the process of joining together for collective prayer services, Tefillah B'Tzibur, replaced the worship of the tabernacle and the temple. We also know that Pinchas and his descendants, the Kohanim, no longer hold a monopoly on facilitating worship. Their role has been replaced by the Shlichei Tzibur, our representatives in prayer, cantors and rabbis who help to offer the worship service in a meaningful way that unites congregants. But the purpose of gathering for avodah, public worship, remains the same. It is to allow us to reach out towards God, however we understand God, and in doing so to create greater peace in our community and in our world. Jewish communal prayer has been defined as praying alone together. We each do our own thing, but we must do it with other Jews, usually a minion of them. That's because it is only in combination with others who have dreams and needs that are both similar and unlike our own that we can seek to create a true Brit Shalom, a covenant of peace. In our combinations, we are greater than we can possibly be alone. And in our prayer, we can successfully reach out to God in true avodah, worship that transforms. On this coming Shabbat, may we gather for our own Tefillah B'Tzibur, our truly collective prayer, and through that sacred process find inspiration from our service. May this joined experience help us realize our spiritual potential for peace through working together. Then our combined prayer may reach the one God who listens to all the different voices. Our guest this morning, Dahlia Rosenfeld, lives in Israel, but is also deeply rooted in the U.S. Her wonderful collection of short stories, The World We Think We Know, is Jewish, pointed, sensitive, thoughtful, funny, and wise, and a great book to read. Find out all about it when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Portugal has approved about a third of approximately 33,000 applications for citizenship under its 2015 law for descendants of Sephardic Jews. Applications based on the 2015 law, primarily from Israel, Turkey, Brazil, and Venezuela, are the reason for a 10% increase in applications in 2018. There were more than 41,000 such requests then, Portugal reported last month. It was the highest tally in at least 5 years. Israel, which used to provide Portugal no more than a few dozen new citizens a year before the 2015 law, provided 4,289 applications in 2018, second highest number of any country after Brazil. Israelis submitted more applications for naturalization to Portugal than even former Portuguese colonies like Cape Verde and Angola. Citizens of Turkey, who in past years made very few applications for Portuguese citizenship, accounted for 1,141 last year. Venezuelans submitted over 500 such requests. The Foreigners and Borders Service of Portugal said the increase is owed primarily to the law about descendants of Sephardic Jews, passed in 2015. Portugal passed that law shortly before Spain passed a similar law, which is more restrictive and ends in October of this year. Thousands of descendants of Sephardim have obtained Spanish citizenship. Portugal's law, however, is open-ended. Both countries said the law was to atone for the church-led persecution of Jews in the 15th and 16th centuries, including the expulsion and the Inquisition. In France, a Muslim man who murdered his Jewish neighbor in Paris while shouting about Allah will probably not be held criminally responsible for his actions because he smoked marijuana beforehand, a French judge ruled. The preliminary ruling in the trial of Kobili Traor for the 2017 murder of Sarah Halimi came last week from a judge of inquiry, a magistrate that in the French system is tasked with deciding whether indicted defendants should stand trial. The killer could be hospitalized for treatment of his psychotic lapses or made to attend a drug rehab program, or he could be released. Francis Khalifat, the president of the CRIF umbrella group of French Jewish communities, called the ruling unsurprising but hardly justifiable. He said his group and others will appeal in hopes of bringing Traor to trial. Khalifat's op-ed on the Jewish community website followed a series of protests over perceived delays in Traor's trial and the efforts, including by judges, that CRIF and others have condemned as attempts to prevent a murder trial. Sammy Gozlan, former police commissioner, founder of France's Bureau for Vigilance Against Anti-Semitism, said that the handling of the Halimi case has made him no longer have full confidence that anti-Semitic hate crimes in France are handled properly. Traor brutalized Halimi, beating her. She was a physician and a kindergarten teacher. He tortured her for an hour as police stood outside the woman's door, according to reports. He shouted about Allah, called her a demon, and then threw her to her death. Traor had called Halimi's daughter dirty Jewess a couple of years before killing the mother. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Dahlia Rosenfeld, is the delightful author of The Worlds We Think We Know, a remarkable collection of short stories. It was a finalist for the Rohrer Literary Prize, which is a big deal. She grew up, as we heard, Bloomington, Indiana, immersed in the Jewish studies program there by heritage, I guess. That must have made for a very interesting upbringing in terms of the people that you got to know. Because everybody, that's a famous Jewish studies program in the country. I'm sure pretty much everybody came through.
Yeah, for sure. We had, you know, very interesting dinner guests from, I remember Elie Wiesel, Primo Levi, a lot of scholars of the Holocaust, which is my father's field of research. And yeah, and I mean, and what's interesting is that, so I had sort of lived under that, with it became a shadow after a while. You lived sort of under the shadow, too, as much as it was enriching. You know, later, it sort of followed me, the shadow of the Holocaust, into the writing, and then in interesting ways when I moved to Israel, in ways I didn't expect, because, of course, the role of the Holocaust in Israel is very different from in the States.
Talk about your choice to make Aliyah.
Oh. I think it's something I'd always dreamt of doing, but, of course, you know, dreams are not often realized, and this one was. I didn't know at the time that I was actually making Aliyah. I thought, you know, it was a sabbatical, and then 1 year became 2 years, 2 years became 3 years, and then I was lucky enough to find employment, and the kids were happy, and so we stayed. And this is our fourth year now here, and I'd been back and forth many, many times before And it's maybe I, you know, if there's any such thing as an accident of history, maybe I was sort of born in the wrong place and sort of meant to be here ultimately. Although, again, great childhood in Bloomington, Indiana. Go Hoosiers.
You mentioned the difference in the perception of the Shoah, of the Holocaust, in the United mm-hmm. States and in Israel. That is certainly true. Explore that a little bit for us, would you?
Sure. So, again, because we're in a different generation, also there are very few survivors left to tell their stories. But mostly what I feel is that in Israel, I feel a great absence of the Holocaust, and not just because there are fewer and fewer survivors, but because Israelis are just very rooted in the present, and they don't seem to... Israelis, of course, are very introspective, like their American Jewish counterparts, but they don't tend to reflect too much on the past, at least not that past. And so, you know, this idea of the new Jew, the Jew rooted to the land and building a country is certainly the ethos of the place still, and not you know, the Diary of Anne Frank, which is something I grew up with and was a transformative experience for me reading her diary. It's not taught in Israel in the curriculum in the schools, and I was really surprised to learn that. So I feel the absence of the Holocaust more than the presence, and that somehow also makes its way into my writing. Also the absence, you know, of anti-Semitism in the way that we experience it in the States, right? We certainly have enemies surrounding us in Israel, but it's a different kind of anti-Semitism that Israelis encounter here.
Right. I mean, the enemies are either other armies with guns or terrorists.
Sure.
It's not this casual thing that's part of society or something that might sneak up
exactly.
on you.
Exactly. It's not a culturally ingrained anti-Semitism then.
You know, it seems to me that the Holocaust in Israel used to be this sort of overriding fear, kind of a thematic element that hung over when I first started going mm-hmm. to Israel long ago.
Mm-hmm.
The fear that it could be repeated. I don't feel that in Israel anymore. Do you think that's still there? Is that only there for older people?
It's certainly used politically. I mean, it's still a charged idea to throw around, you know, for political gain. I don't think effectively. I think it actually does a disservice. To the people using it and to the people employing it and to, of course, the Shoah itself. But I don't think people, there's Holocaust Remembrance Day, Yom HaShoah in Israel with the sirens that blare for a minute or two, and that's incredibly moving for everybody. And people do, there's nobody really who doesn't respect that moment and come to a standstill. Maybe that's enough. Maybe that moment once a year and the Yad Vashem Museum, which is incredible, and the school visits to Yad Vashem and to Poland, maybe that's how it's expressed, and not through reading books about the Holocaust and through sort of discussions about it in terms of how we plan the future. But it's certainly in the minds of politicians, and we certainly invoked as a never again cry when people deem it necessary.
In your writing, you have a great skill for bringing out small detail,
mm-hmm.
Which seemingly, I think that's one of the, not all writers have that talent, that those in those small elements you bring out sort of the trivial aspects of life and then somehow the significant. Is that intentional?
I hope it's more intuitive than intentional, but as long as it works, I'm happy with either theory. No, but the truth is, I think, especially when writing about Israel, you know, it's such a heavy, daunting subject to write about, and for the writing not to become politicized or didactic, or I try to just focus on the daily observations I make when I'm sitting at a cafe or just walking down the street, and I try to capture those. In the stories rather than just reducing Israel to an idea or a concept. It's very tempting to sort of describe Tel Aviv and all the stray cats wandering around, but that's also become an overused image. So a friend of mine suggested
Stop
the other day
the
that
cats,
I write about.
Right?
Yeah. And of course, food, right? Food is ubiquitous and we live for food here and everything revolves around food. But then that's also tricky. So my friend said, you know, why don't you write about food falling out of people's mouths when they speak? Because Israelis have this energy. And sometimes, you know, they get ahead of themselves. And it's true. You can, you know, why not describe somebody who's eating, talking, gesticulating, and food is falling out of his mouth. So that's my next scene for tomorrow's short story.
See, that's, I never would have thought of that, you know.
Neither would I have. That's good to have friends.
That's right.
Good ideas.
It's good to get that feedback. If you were going to summarize the difference, because I think in some ways you embody this between, in your stories, American Judaism and Israeli Judaism, or the way Judaism affects your writing in both places, how could you analyze that? How would you express that?
Well, certainly, I guess American Jews are more wedded to the idea of, you know, synagogue life as an expression of their Jewishness. Unless you live in New York, where you still got the, you know, the Jewish food and the Jewish culture and the Jewish music, but less so in the small college towns where I lived. So it's sort of institutional Jewish life certainly plays a bigger role in America than in Israel. In Israel, of course, you can claim that, you know, just through the daily language of Hebrew, that's an expression of one's Jewishness, through the food, through different, I would say even through body language. You know, it's completely accepted, right, to use your body to express maybe what words can't. And in America, I think Jews are a little bit more cautious to do that, lest it be pointed out to them that we're too excitable or too rambunctious or aggressive. Or so I think there's just more of a freedom here to express one's Jewishness as whatever, in ways that just make us comfortable without having to conform to any standard.
It always feels to me like Israel is one large dysfunctional family.
For sure. And that makes for great writing. However, to be a good writer, you need tension and drama. And I have to say, I'm so happy here. I don't feel the tension that I felt so much in the States. So
you have to come back to the States more. You get stuck in Iowa in a writer's room or something again to see that tension.
Exactly.
Develop.
Right.
I'll never forget.
It's nice that I can claim the Middle East is a place where I can live free of conflict.
How could you be the only person to live in the Middle East without conflict? That can't possibly be true.
It's called compartmentalization, I think.
It just might be. Maybe it's an American take on Israel, too. You know, it's not when you read Israeli authors that there's a lack of tension in their writing.
Right.
Somehow.
No, for sure.
Who were your greatest influences on your writing so far?
Oh, boy. That's a good question. I kind of have an eclectic taste in what I read. I mean, here it was imposed on me in Tel Aviv because I find a lot of people just leave books abandoned on benches for people to take, so I'll just read whatever I have to find that day. So I've recently discovered Zadie Smith. Again, I don't know if these, I guess one way or another they influence my writing, but Zadie Smith I hadn't read until now, you know, so I'm way late in being introduced to her. In terms of early influences, definitely like the old Jewish writers, the Philip Roth and the Saul Bellow and Malamud for sure. All the books that were in my, you know, parents' bookshelves, and a lot of the Holocaust writers. I mentioned the Diary of Anne Frank. That was definitely formative for me when I read it. And now I'm just, I read very sort of haphazardly and whatever I get my hands on.
You also teach creative writing still?
Mm-hmm.
This is a really bad question, but how do you teach creative writing?
Oh, that's actually a very good question, because it's the first question people ask when they come into the classroom. In terms of the tools I can give writers, as long as my students are writing, I can feel pretty confident that they'll become better writers after their you know, degree is conferred to them. Because I can sharpen the skills they come with and give them new tools. New ways of reading also is very helpful for learning how to write. But yes, there is that intuition they'll need to have that maybe can't be defined and can't be taught. And that's the case, I guess, with any art form, with music and art. There's a certain degree to which it can't be taught. But I certainly feel, I don't feel like I'm faking it. I feel like the tools I'm giving them are genuine and helpful, and I learn from them too. So it's a back and forth,
a kind of covenantal relationship in that way.
Ooh, that sounds even better.
Thank you. You can. I got it from Judaism. I didn't really make it up. So.
I'm going to use that.
Please.
I'll give you credit for it.
B'shem Omro, always. Your stories are also often funny, even while they're sometimes tragic and poignant. Mm-hmm. Do you consciously seek that?
Probably. I mean, it's hard to be funny and I think a lot of the situations that the ones that are especially sort of have potential for, yeah, like tragedy or where the where there's suffering in internal struggles going on within the characters, I think that that's can be those are invitations to find humor, right? So I mean, as a tool of, as a survival mechanism, a defense mechanism maybe, and the humor is often, you know, expressed through ironic situations that aren't sort of inherently funny, but the way they occur can lead to sort of a series of events that end up being what you don't expect, sort of contrary to your expectations. The discrepancy between sort of appearances and reality that can be funny. But I don't really set out. It's not like witty. I don't try to be witty or ha-ha funny,
right?
Although I do like stand-up.
Yeah. Tell us about your new book or the book that you're working on. Your parallel move. Wait, that wasn't the right term.
Parallel is good.
Okay. Your lateral move. Thank you very much. Towards
that might come from. That might be like a sports term. I'm thinking it might.
It is lateral sports. Movement's a big thing in basketball in particular.
I was thinking football.
And well, no, that's probably right. Almost everything. Shortstop in baseball, lineman in football, lateral movement. Yep. Okay.
Right,
your lateral move to the novel.
To the novel. So it's funny because back to the dislocation and writing, you know, about places where I no longer live, it by pure coincidence, the novel is set in alternating chapters between Tel Aviv, where I currently live, and Charlottesville, Virginia, where I lived before moving to Tel Aviv. So I go back and forth in each chapter between these two places. And it's a novel about, it's a novel about love and explored in three different ways, sort of the love between familial love between a mother and her children, and the love for one's country, and a sort of romantic love that develops later on in the book. It's a novel that's very deeply rooted in Israel, and that the main character sees three different versions of Israel through her three very different children. So she's exploring. She Israel comes to life through the experiences her teenage children have as they grew up there.
Well, we will look forward to reading it when it comes out and having you back.
Give me another year or two.
God willing, as we say in my business.
Yes, exactly.
I want to thank Dahlia Rosenfeld for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Your book is The Worlds We Think We Know. Highly recommended. Where can people go to find out more about you and about your writing?
I think I probably have a website somewhere, which
you do,
which my brother set up for me. I have a website, and the book, of course, can be purchased on through Amazon. If anyone's heard of that business,
yeah, small company. I don't think they're.
But if you can find it at your independent bookstore, please look for it.
If you can find your independent bookstore, then find the book.
Exactly.
The Worlds We Think
We Know. Find the bookstore, then you have to find the book.
Find
exactly.
Dahlia, thank you so much. Really
Thanks
appreciate
so much
it.
Thanks so much to you. Okay, it was fun.
When we come back on Too Jewish with her about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be Mark Sarvas, author of the award-winning novel Memento Park. Our playout this morning comes to the Israeli-Yemenite trio Awa and their international hit Abib Galbi. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.